Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Well, hopefully this Herb Alpert song will resonate with Bill Schnee, who's on the phone with us. He is an author of a book entitled Chairman of the Board. And what Chairman at the Board, because the board in this particular case are the controls and recording studios that artists use to make music. And Bill is internationally renowned as a producer and engineer and a mix master. He's received over 125 gold and platinum records and more than 50 top 20 singles that run the gamut from Barbra Streisand to the Jacksons, Rod Stewart, Steely Dan, Whitney Houston, Dire Straits. But other than that, nobody. Hey, Bill, how are you? Welcome to WGN. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, good. I'm fine, thank you. Does that, how does Lonely, do you recognize the Lonely Bull tune by Herb Alpert?
Yes, that's one of the very first records I bought when I started getting into hi-fi.
Yes, that's what I gleaned from Chairman at the Board. I have to tell you that our backgrounds are somewhat similar. I mean, they diverge.
Really?
Yeah. My parents were of a very serious variety. Classical music was the order of the day. And when I got it, said I wanted to be, you know, in a disc jockey on the radio. I mean, I never had them say things like, well, why don't you get a business degree? You'll always have it there to fall back on. But they were, you know, like a little, what kind of job is this? And your background, from what I read, is at least similar to that point in that.
Yeah.
Your parents were of a more serious variety with classical music, and you wanted to rock and roll, so to speak. Am I right?
Yeah. Well, my dad was a Jewish doctor, and of course, you know, that meant that I was going to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Right.
And that wasn't about to happen in terms of medicine, at least. But actually, as I got into recording to make shut them up, so to speak, I did start law school. I did the first semester and got the grades in the second semester. And I had been faking it; they were all C's and a B. And I knew, you know, you got to learn the beginning to build upon over the course of the 3 years. So I decided to quit for a year and a half. I had quit several years earlier. I quit college for 2.5 years, chasing my band. Looking for stardom. And so I figured I could quit the law school for a year and a half. And if music made it, great. And if it didn't, I'd go back and get the degree and try again.
Now, this is all in the Los Angeles area, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I was about a year went by. I was getting ready to enroll for the fall semester to start back up again. And a friend of mine that I had worked with in music got a job with Columbia Records, and he told Clive Davis about me. And one day I was mixing in a studio, and the girl buzzed in the control room and said, Bill, Clive Davis is on the phone. And I went, really? And I picked up the phone, quite nervous, and, hello? Hi, Bill, Clive Davis, how are you? Oh, I'm doing good. He said, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I think I'm going to finish law school. And he said, no, you don't want to go to law school. I went to law school. You want to do music. And if it's in your blood, that's what you're going to do. And I said, yeah, well, I would like to do it. But and he basically took the butt away, gave me a shot, and the legal system is much happier for it.
And so's the world of contemporary music. Let's go back to this high school band of yours, though. The L.A. Teens? Is that the name of the band?
Yeah, that's it.
The L.A. Teens.
Yeah.
Now, you're in high school LA in L.A. Teens. Yeah, obviously in L.A.,
yeah.
John, you idiot. But the reason I keep mentioning that is, you know, in that part of the country, you have access to people like Clive Davis and recording studios, and people are looking for new material to feed the show business machinery. So you came close with the high school band while you were in high school, right?
No, right after.
Right after.
We started, yeah, my parents moved to Los Angeles my senior year of high school. I met some kids that were starting a band, and I joined with them, and we started doing gigs and, you know, bowling alleys and sock hops and anywhere else that they could play in those days. And we saved our pennies and went into a local recording studio and cut four of our songs. And one of the kids in the band, his mom knew someone who knew someone that was in the music business. And that someone was a guy named Gary Usher. And Gary was good friends with the Beach Boys, the Wilson family. In fact, he wanted to be a Beach Boy, and it didn't work out. However, he did write 409 and In My Room with Brian Wilson. So he had a production deal with Decca Records and heard our demos and thought that we had something and signed us to a deal.
Wow.
And in those days, you went in and recorded four songs. They put out a single or two. And if you managed to hit, then you ran it, cut six more songs to make an album.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there is no L.A. Teens album.
Right. But there were... There was a point about a certain song, though, and I should have, All I Really Want to Do, or...
All I Really Want to Do was our second single. That was, it's a Bob Dylan song.
Right.
And I really thought we had it with that one, but unfortunately, when they got ready to release it, it turned out that Cher recorded it. It was her first single without Sonny, and so the L.A. Teens didn't stand a chance.
And that was the end of the L.A. Teen, so to speak.
Yeah. The first single was interesting, though, because, you know, things were so different in radio back then.
Yeah.
You could, the disc jockey could actually play the B-side, and that's exactly what happened. Our A-side that Gary Usher thought was the big hit didn't get any kind of traction, but started with one DJ and then several turned it over, and they liked the other song. The other side better, and so that we actually did make a bit of noise. In fact, it's funny, I have a chart of a station in California where we're ahead of the Beatles, and meanwhile, I'm sure that they were on their way to number one while we had already peaked.
Yeah, well, but, you know, that's the way it was that particular day. They're not going to take that away from you. We're going to find out what happens next when we come back on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, John Landecker, thanks for joining us. Obviously, this is the very iconic intro to Ringo Starr's tune, Photograph. And that's something Bill Schnee, who's on the phone with us, had something to do with as a mixer, as an engineer, as a producer, and has a book out called Chairman at the board being the control board. And listen to this. Just a few of the artists that Bill has worked with in the production of music that you and I have enjoyed for years. Barbra Streisand, Carly Simon, Ringo Starr, All the Beatles, Art Garfunkel, the Pointer Sisters, Huey Lewis and the News, Boz Scaggs, Chicago, Ringo, Dire Straits, Miles Davis, Natalie Cole, Marvin Gaye, The Jacksons, Pablo Cruz, George Benson, Aaron Neville, Barry Manilow, Bette Midler, Amy Grant, Joe Sample, Rod Stewart, and Whitney Houston, including...
Gesundheit.
Including I Will Always Love You, the mega spectacular Whitney Houston song that was written by Dolly Parton. You do something that has always intrigued me, and I've never really been able to get my head around it because it's such a technical, of such technical nature. Can you define for us what happens, how exactly one mixes a song?
Okay, very quickly. So what happens in the typical manner of recording that we've had basically since the 60s, they started tape recording on multi-tracks. so that you could not just record an ensemble, but you could go in and overdub,
right,
and add to it. And that's when a lot of things started changing, and the engineer became much more important in the process of record making, because it opened up a whole new, basically, palette of brushes, colors and brushes to paint with. And so we went from basically 4-track to 8-track to 16 to 24 to now we're recording primarily with computers, where we have almost an unlimited number of tracks, literally, 170 if you need them. And who needs 170? But anyway, so when all of the tracks are assembled, which will include, the different instruments and vocals and background vocals and whatnot, then the process of mixing is where all of that is combined to hopefully a good aesthetic. And that's where the you can do things with equalization, tone controls, shaping the tones of different instruments or voices, and with dimension, with things like delays or reverberation, echoes, that kind of thing, to give space and depth. And compression, where you can limit the dynamic range of an instrument, which kind of fattens it up and changes its character a bit. And so those are the, touch of some of the tools that we have to put all this together. And then the actual mixing, so to speak, is the combining of the instruments so that it, again, feels like a piece of music and not a, not all these varied tracks that may have been done over a long period of time by a bunch of different engineers, artists, everything.
I'm trying to form this question in the way the intricate application of shading and some of the other dynamics that you mentioned are items that I don't even know people would be able to discern if they heard it. But the artist in the recording process is so technically finite that each particular track, as far as I understand it, is gone over and over and over and over and over again to get a certain something that everyone's looking for. I mean, even a single instrument. If there's a horn part or something, that horn will be EQ'd and compressed and gone over and over and over and over again. Am I correct?
There you go, talking about Steely Dan. with some people, that's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Some people, some people paint with rather broad brushes, and other people, have very fine points on their tips of their very small brushes. Not everyone is like that, but and I'm one of those that tends to not like that. I like to shoot from the hip. I find creativity, moving along at a nice clip, as opposed to, putting the microscope onto the process.
Well, you've worked with
that
such
was the
a
reason.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Worked with such. I was going to say the reason I didn't mix Asia. I recorded the tracks, but I didn't mix it. I told them I didn't think I could mix with them, and they said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because my style is just very different than yours." And they said, "Well, you'll try, won't you?" And I said, "Sure." And so down the road, when they'd labored over their overdubs for 6 months, we went into the studio with one of the songs, "When Josie Comes Home," and spent a day mixing, and at the end they could tell I was getting frustrated and they wanted to just keep going. And I said, "You see, guys, it's just, I don't think it's a good combination, but you've got a phenomenal album and it's going to be wonderful." And indeed it was,
and good luck performing it live. I mean, if you're so that's another thing. If you're building a sound in a studio and then an artist goes out to perform it live, there's a challenge there, isn't there? That for them to recreate, at least to a certain extent, the sound that is on the record, but they're in a live situation?
Well, it used to be that way. What goes on today in the computer era is that we, you know, a lot of acts will take a computer on the road with whatever they can't do live being played from the computer, and they just play along. They just play along with the computer, and the computer fills in what they can't. And that's, you know, that's how all of the dancing acts do it, because you can't dance unless you're Michael Jackson. You can't dance like a maniac and sing perfect vocals.
Michael
was amazing that way. I did a live album with he and his brothers, and they didn't film it, unfortunately, but there was a camera on stage from the recording truck so that I could see what was going on, who was playing what. And the first couple of nights, I forgot to mix. I just sat there watching this guy in total amazement of his brilliance.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Where did you get the technical training for the what you ended up doing, which is, you know, you mentioned some of these equalization and et cetera, and I've never figured it out. How did you, where did you learn your craft, so to speak?
Well, the thing is, you know, I was a musician, obviously, and but all my aptitude in school was in math and science. In fact, when I enrolled in college, I enrolled in aerospace.
And,
so what was fortunate for me is that I came across a guy that believed in me, and I don't know why, because what he was hearing with my very, very first recordings in this very Mickey Mouse studio I was working in. But he is a very, very patient man. Toby Foster's his name. Very patient man, very, very good technically, actually a great orchestral engineer himself. And he basically taught me all of the basics. I always refer to him as, when I introduce him, as this is the guy who taught me everything I know. And he worked in a studio, and I had gone back to college after my 2.5 year stint with the LA Teens. And every day after school, I would drive to his studio and just start barraging him with questions. And he would take as much as he could, and then they would come to a very sad moment for me when he'd say, "That's enough, see you tomorrow," and send me on my way. So where the creative side of me in the right brain met the left brain, it came very natural, very quickly, I should say, to me, the technical side of it. So I'm very fortunate for that.
Yeah, like you were supposed to be doing that. I mean, like that was your calling. And once you got there, you realized it, as did all these artists that I've mentioned that you worked with. It's an incredible resume. I mean, it is a mind blower. If you listen to Top 40 Radio, you know, and these artists that I've mentioned, every single friggin' song that you know, Bill worked on, I bet. I mean, I'd laid money down on it. The book is called Chairman at the Board. Bill, thank you so much for being with us. It's a great book. If you want to find out about how rock and roll and music in general is recorded and what goes into it to hear what you come out of it, it's just very fascinating. Each chapter is named after a song, and I really enjoyed reading it. Thanks for being with us, Bill. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
You bet. Chairman at the Board, Bill Schnee, Grammy Award-winning audio engineer.